Be seated, please. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050882, Perry Holmes and others versus Robert E. Cole and Jane Cole.
I represent Perry Holmes, a joint venture, and homeowners in Multiple Equity, Inc., and Warranty Underwriters Insurance Company, which are the warranty companies that provided warranty service for the Cole's home. For the court to note as an initial factual matter, that Perry Holmes has no arbitration clause in its sales contract with the Cole's or any of its customers, never has, and did not opt out of the judicial system or want a good arbitration and oppose the same from the get-go in this case. It's important for this court to try and give some guidance to the trial courts of this state, because as a threshold matter, what happens is people go to the courthouse, plaintiffs or defendants for that matter, with the knowledge that they have an arbitration clause. And this court needs to come up with a workable rule for the trial courts in an effort to determine whether or not a party, by engaging the judicial machinery, waives his or her right to arbitration. We think in this case, because of the procedural choices that were made in the trial court by the Coles, they have waived their right to arbitration.
So the basis for your clients defending the arbitration, going to arbitration, is equitable estoppel. It's based on the contracts and the other parties, the provisions in the other parties' contracts. So what's the basis?
Well, the basis would be waiver by the Culls with regard to their right to arbitrate against any of the defendants, either the two warranty defendants with whom they had the arbitration clause or Perry Holmes with whom they had no arbitration clause.
Well, let me put that the other way. What was the basis for then your client being sent to arbitration?
The order of Judge Farrar on December 13th of 2000.
Based on what theory?
Based upon the theory that there was no waiver by virtue of the 13 months of trial conduct by the Culls, and that visiting Judge Farrar decided that the case should go to arbitration.
I think what Justice Wainwright is asking is, you just said that there is no contract by Perry Holmes, between Perry Holmes and the Coles specifically, in which Perry Holmes agreed to arbitrate claims. So by what theory would Perry Holmes be required to arbitrate anyway?
Yes, sir. Justice Wainwright, in the warranty documents, Perry Holmes would have an obligation for the first year after the home was closed to repair certain defects. There is an arbitration clause in the warranty documents, not in the sales contract between Perry Holmes and the Culls. And I suspect that what Judge Farrar looked at was the arbitration clause in the warranty documents. The significant point here, of course,
who would the Culls seek the warranty from?
The warranty flows for the first year from the builder, in this case Perry Holmes, a joint venture, and then for the remaining 9 years from the warranty company.
Then it seems to me that there is an arbitration clause if Perry Holmes is going to be the ultimate beneficiary of that warranty claim.
That might be true, Your Honor, if you were in the first year of the warranty, but in fact the evidence in this record is that the Culls didn't bring their claim until 4 years after it related to a construction defect regarding the slab, which is a 10-year obligation of the warranty companies, and it wasn't brought until 4 years after the purchase, so it would have been outside of the one-year limited warranty that a builder would give under these sort of warranty documents.
Okay, so they're outside the contract.
Yes, sir.
And then they have a right to go to trial.
Well, they have the right to go to trial based upon the litigation conduct of the Culls. Remember, the Culls, early on when the warranty defendants brought before the trial court the issue of the waiver of the arbitration, it was the Culls' position that it would be, and I think the language is affirmatively stated in enforcement by the court, would be nothing short of ridiculous and absurd. So in this case, on this record, you have the Culls not only impliedly waiving their right to arbitration, but expressly, early on in the litigation, saying, don't send this to arbitration. We think that arbitration is unconscionable. And then what happened during the remaining 13 months is they took 11 depositions. They admittedly took discovery that would not otherwise be available to them in the arbitration.
Okay, I want to ask you about that, because you've said that also in your brief, that much of the discovery here would not have been available in arbitration. And I just couldn't find support for that assertion. In most typical arbitration agreements, the arbitrator has free rein with respect to discovery. And was that not the case here, and how was it not?
Well, the parties, as the court was well aware, issues of arbitration are contractual choices that parties make. Here, the parties chose the arbitrable forum to be the AAA. The rule we cited, I think it's 32, Your Honor, says that there's no provision in the rules for depositions. There's certainly no provision in the arbitration rules of the AAA, commercial industry arbitration rules that provide for requests for admissions, requests for disclosures under Rule 194, all of which were provided and used by the Culls. And remember, of course, the Culls went to the trial court during that 13-month time period some five times in order to secure discovery orders and resulting in the production of over 2,000 pages of documents. So if there's a question about whether or not the Culls...
So you say, you say Rule 32 precludes depositions?
There is nothing in the arbitration rules, Your Honor, the AAA rules, that provides for depositions.
So does it exclude can an arbitrator under AAA rules order depositions or not? Or is it just unclear?
It's unclear, Your Honor. The only rule regarding discovery that I'm aware of in AAA is the production of documents. That is not to say, Your Honor, that arbitrators don't typically allow for depositions, but there's no rule in the AAA that specifically allows an arbitrator to do that.
And, in fact, depositions were taken in this case through the arbitration process.
I believe the fact witnesses were all taken in the trial court, some 11 or 12 of them. And I do believe that there was several expert witness depositions that were taken incident to the arbitration, Your Honor.
Now, you said they expressly waived the right to arbitration. Why can't they change their mind? What binds them to arbitration? Because they take one position during a course of litigation and for whatever strategic reason change their mind. Why can't they do that?
Well, the court, having been a trial court judge, is burdened with a lot of cases. And you have a party clearly knowing on this record that they were subject to an arbitration clause and brought suit. Cases in the federal district, if what this court is trying to do is harmonize Texas's law with the federal courts, which I think needs to be done since it's uncontroversial dealing with the Federal Arbitration Act here, says that you can't get the judicial machinery going. You can't institute a suit in the first instance, take all the discovery to which you think you're entitled under the civil rules, and then use that discovery later on to the detriment of the party in arbitration. And
where do you think the cutoff should be?
If I were king, I believe that there should be a presumptive waiver. If a party, knowing of an arbitration clause, brings suit, that's what the cabinetry case says. That appears to be where Miller Brewing is going in the Fifth Circuit.
Let me follow up on that. The discussion a little bit earlier on about Perry Holmes, whether the arbitration clause was in its agreement or in its warranty. Perry Holmes could have pursued arbitration itself in this case, correct? You don't contest that.
Well, I do contest that because I'm not sure we were governed by an arbitration agreement. But that's the point I'm trying to make, Justice O'Neill, is it's incumbent upon either the plaintiff or the defendant to bring to the attention of the trial court that there's a viable arbitration clause.
Well, the point I'm getting to here is Perry Holmes did that. Perry Holmes did say there's an arbitration clause here, right?
Warranty defendants did, Your Honor. Perry Holmes did not. Perry Holmes never wanted to go to arbitration in this case.
Okay, well then, I understand that. But my question is, would they have had the right to compel it? Presume with me that they would have.
Okay.
Presume with me that they would have had the right to compel it under our jurisprudence. And presume that they raise it, but they don't pursue it. Then, if they decide not to go forward with arbitration early on in the proceedings, why should we hold the plaintiff to a different waiver standard than a defendant in that circumstance?
Well, as you addressed in the Citigroup capital markets case, I mean, I think what you need to do is look at the litigation conduct of both parties. And based upon this record, the parties thought they were going to trial. The parties conducted discovery.
No, I think he misunderstood my question. I understand the waiver by proceeding down the litigation road for too long. But you've made the argument that a plaintiff should be held to a different waiver standard than a defendant. And my question is, if the defendant had the right to compel arbitration in its own right but didn't, then why in that situation will we apply a different standard? I can see how a different standard might apply in some circumstances. But if both can compel and neither do, until the last minute. Shouldn't we evaluate it under how far they moved down the litigation process as opposed to apply a different standard for the plaintiff?
I don't think so. I mean, I think you need to look at both of the parties, and that brings up the prejudice issue, which is, I think, where the court is going on this is, should there be a different standard of prejudice? In my humble opinion, I don't think there should be a prejudice requirement for either a plaintiff or a defendant. The reason I say that is, if you look at the federal cases that we've cited in our briefs, the cabinetry case in particular, there is no prejudice requirement. And if we're trying to harmonize this state's law with federal law and other jurisdictions that have addressed this issue, I think the better rule is to not require prejudice and look at simply waiver and see if the parties have intentionally relinquished a known right.
Assuming we disagree and think prejudice ought to be required, what record evidence is there specifically that Perry Holmes suffered prejudice here?
If the court will remember, we asked both Judge Farrar and Judge Lowe to take judicial notice of its file. In that file, which is voluminous, you will see reams of discovery, including part of the discovery that I've already explained would not otherwise be available to and someone who is arbitrating. But in addition, you had increased litigation costs of approximately $50,000 and an affidavit from trial counsel in the record to that effect. And it's uncontroverted that the discovery was in fact used in arbitration because, unlike some of the other cases that this court has considered, we brought the record from the arbitration before you. So it's not like there is a presumption that discovery wasn't used. We know it was used.
Let me just following up on that point, ask you that if we assume that all the discovery, and this goes back to an earlier question, all the discovery that actually took place here would have occurred even if the case had immediately proceeded to arbitration. If that were so, then you would not have been harmed by arbitrating the case. Is that correct?
Well, I think if the case had immediately gone within the 30 days or whenever it was that the Culls contested.
Immediately, and assume that all the same discovery would have taken place, then there would have been no harm.
All the same discovery in the arbitration?
That took place in the trial court proceeding and in the arbitration. All the discovery that took place here from beginning to end had taken place after arbitration was immediately pursued. Then there would be no harm.
Right. That's not what happened from a factual matter, and you know it couldn't have happened because we went 13 months.
I'm just saying, what if the arbitrator had entertained all of the motions to compel answers to interrogatories, compelled depositions, all the same things that the trial court considered, and made the same rulings? Then there would be no harm.
That's a possibility, Your Honor.
Counsel,
other than the cost that you know, whatever cost you incurred. But that
would be purely hypothetical. I mean, once the discovery is done, it's done. There's no reason you ask the arbitrator to compel it again.
Right.
And I have one other question about how and warranty underwriters. If I understand your argument correctly, the Culls are essentially stopped because they opposed arbitration very early on. Why isn't Howe and Warranty Underwriters similarly stopped because they proposed arbitration early on?
Well, again, I don't know that estoppel necessarily
is the right term. But
as I was trying to explain to Justice Medina, maybe I didn't do it effectively. The trial court at some point in time has to decide, am I going to take the case or have the parties made a conscious decision to put the judicial machinery in place? And the truth of the matter is, whether the warranty companies filed their motion to compel arbitration and let it lie is really irrelevant because we know that at that point in time they decided to go to trial. They decided to be under the trial court's jurisdiction with all its procedural safeguards now. I mean, we haven't really touched on that, but that's one of the real harm in what the Culls did here is you have procedural safeguards when you're dealing with motions to compel proprietary and confidential information before our trial courts. And we entrust our trial courts to apply the law and apply the rules. You don't have any of those procedural protections in arbitration, and that's why arbitration is what it is. It's kind of what you get with very limited rules, as I've already explained.
But you argued earlier for a sort of presumptive cutoff for the defendants. And it strikes me as waiver is really a two-way street, it seems, and it strikes me as sort of fairly audacious for the warranty companies who initially sought arbitration to later complain when the trial court orders exactly that.
The reason I don't see it as such a disconnect, Your Honor, is because at one point in time, the parties need to decide, do you want to litigate this matter or do you want to arbitrate this matter? And clearly, the warranty companies decided we want to litigate this matter. We have a trial court, and they proceeded to go to litigation, and it wasn't until 4 days from the scheduled jury trial that the Culls did an about-face and decided that they didn't want to go to arbitration. Excuse me, they didn't want to go to trial. They wanted to go to arbitration. So I think based upon this record, you have not only an express renunciation by the plaintiffs of their desire to go to arbitration, but impliedly by their litigation conduct, which is addressed in the Wessick case, which we cited to the court.
But why wouldn't the presumptive cutoff that you argue for when plaintiff files a lawsuit, you say presumptive cutoff, you gotta file a lawsuit, you gotta pursue the litigation. Why doesn't that presumptive cutoff work on the defense side as well? Why is there a different rule there you're seeking?
The issue here is not that the warrant companies wanted to go to arbitration. To the contrary, when the issue was finally brought before the judge in Tarrant County, all three defendants said, we've been going down this trail for 13 months. We don't want to go to arbitration, not any of us. And the reason I said presumptive waiver is because, as the court knows, there can be issues about whether or not claims are arbitrable. And so when I use the word presumptive waiver, it's incumbent upon the trial court to see, are these claims something that can be arbitrated? And so it would be incumbent upon the party that has brought the suit or wants to engage the judicial machinery to come before the trial court and say, we haven't waived it here because this is not an arbitrable claim. We either don't fall within the scope of the arbitration agreement, and you know, or we had to file the suit because limitations was run.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Bracken.
You.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Thomas Michel, and I represent Bob and Jane Cull. I would like to address some quick issues in response to the opening argument. And I think the real issue before this court is not necessarily even whether a waiver occurred or did not occur below. It's whether this court should even hear that waiver issue at this point. And I'll tell you why. First reason is that if you go back to the motion to compel arbitration hearing, at that time, Perry Holmes, the only one who filed an opposition, it was 5 pages long. In that opposition, they did not raise the fact that the Culls objected to arbitration. And I'll get to the merits about whether they did or didn't object to arbitration. But as the case proceeded in front of Judge Farrar, at that hearing, at that motion to compel, the only issue that was raised by Perry Holmes was that you have the two-prong test. You have to substantially invoke the judicial process, and it has to operate to be a substantial detriment to the opposing party. Harry Holmes' lawyer stated that and briefed it, that that was the standard that the trial court was to abide by. Judge Farrar accepted that standard in his rulings and, in fact, quoted it back to Perry Holmes, saying, under your own standard, you don't get there on prejudice.
Sometimes people have the nerve not to ask the trial court to reverse the Texas Supreme Court, if that's what we've said the rule is, and wait till they get up here and ask us to reverse ourselves. In fact, we would probably rather the system worked that way. Now, weren't you, in effect, asked, if they had to say there's no prejudice requirement, pay no attention to that detrimental reliance, they would have had to disregard some of our cases.
Arguably,
would have had to just ignore us.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. The cases they're arguing right now, the cases they've recited to this court, were around for a long time. They were around before this case was even argued to Judge Farrar.
Said in In Re Service Corp that merely taking part in litigation is not enough unless you substantially invoked the judicial process to your opponent's detriment. Now, to make an argument to the trial judge, pay no attention to opponent's detriment, you would have to ignore our 2002 opinion, wouldn't you?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Of course.
What's the next argument?
Service was before the hearing. But in any event, there's no doubt that issue was not presented to the court, and they raised that argument. The issue of
counsel, is your position that we are to review what happened before the arbitration, or is it your position that we have to review the arbitrator's award? What is it we're supposed to be reviewing up here in your, insofar as you're concerned,
yes,
if anything?
Yeah, I don't believe the court should even be reviewing the waiver issue.
And why not?
First of all, the waiver issue was presented at the motion to compel arbitration. Up until this case, and both sides have...
Let's go. Are we reviewing what happened before arbitration? Or is your position we should not even be reviewing what happened before arbitration?
Well, I have multiple arguments, Your Honor. Number one, I raise the issue that waiver is not a statutory ground to set aside a
under the FAA?
Yes, Your Honor.
But you have two others, one of them being manifest...
Yes, Your Honor.
Disregard of the law. So are we reviewing what the arbitrator did, or is it your position we should be reviewing what the arbitrator did under manifest disregard of the law, or what the trial court did?
I believe, Your Honor, that my first position is that it would be whether the arbitrator had made a manifest disregard of the law when it denied Perry Holmes' argument in arbitration that waiver occurred.
Okay, so that was that was in the arbitration.
It was at the motion to compel arbitration hearing. It was rejected by Judge Farrar. It was presented in front of the arbitrator. It was rejected by the arbitrator.
Okay, since we do have an arbitration award here, why are we talking in your mind about what happened in the trial court?
I don't think we should be.
Wasn't there a mandamus in regard to that?
There were two. And both of them were denied, one by the Court of Appeals and one by this court.
Of course,
I don't know why we're talking about waiver right now.
Well, courts don't waive things, do we?
Courts don't waive things?
When we don't grant mandamus, we don't waive the right that everything you did was right.
No, but the expressed issue...
The whole purpose of the adequate remedy by appeal is... We may change our minds and say it was wrong to have done this.
Well, with all due respect, I don't believe that's the case. This court has gone at great lengths for the past 15 years to create the appellate or mandamus remedy and to protect the arbitration process. And for the past 15 years has granted review of that issue. And waiver was presented. And it makes sense because waiver was presented at the trial court. In all due respect, the record, and we'll get to that, the record at that motion to compel arbitration was incredibly weak. There was no evidence of any prejudice.
I thought you said waiver was not raised at the trial court.
Yes, it was raised. It was raised at the trial court at the motion to compel arbitration.
And your theory is
that was Perry Holmes' defense was that they waived it. They put on no evidence, no testimony. They didn't say they had opposed arbitration. They never raised that issue before Judge Farrar. There's no express waiver in this case.
Okay,
it was never presented.
But they didn't argue before the trial court that the Calls had previously objected to mediation.
Arbitration, that's correct.
Why would the trial judge not know that?
Number one, it was a visiting judge. It was never presented. It was filed.
Sitting there in the file.
Yes, Your Honor. But it was never argued in their motion to respond to the motion to compel arbitration.
So
it was never raised.
Is your argument that if there's a question of waiver before you go to arbitration and mandamus, unless we grant it in every case, that decision's unreviewable?
I believe in the arbitration, it would be at the motion to compel arbitration. That is the natural place.
Our president has never said that our denial of a mandamus petition is law of the case on any legal issue that's been presented up here. That would be pretty astounding to embark on that course.
I did raise that argument in saying that because of the unique situation, starting with Anglin, where this court tried to fill the appellate gap, that this court for the past...
But that's when arbitration is denied.
Yes.
There's not an appellate gap when arbitration is granted.
Well, arguably recently under the Palacios decision, but also the Fifth Circuit and this court also left mandamus available even for the unusual circumstances when they grant arbitration.
Well, it might be, but I'm just saying the gap exists on the other side when it's denied.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. That's what we tried to fill. This court has tried to fill that gap. But
let's assume, and maybe you'll convince the court otherwise, that we don't believe that by denying mandamus all the legal issues were fixed and our determination can't be reconsidered. I'd like to go back to the point in time in which you objected to arbitration by AAA. You opposed it because AAA was, among other things, you said, biased. And My question is, why should you be better off today than if the trial court had sustained your objection and denied arbitration when you first opposed arbitration in front of AAA? In other words, had the trial court denied arbitration as you had requested, we wouldn't be here today. And you never withdrew your accusation about AAA's partiality. So why should you be better off than if the trial court had sustained that initial objection?
Well, first of all, I think the record is clear. We did not object to the arbitration process, and we objected to the AAA.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, and number two, the arbitration clause specifically allowed other arbitrators. So they were.
But you went to AAA.
Yes, we did. I don't think that's is where a prejudice or a estoppel would argue, saying we oppose AAA and we would like another arbitrator, which is expressly allowed under the agreement. But to say we're better off, at the end of the day, what happened was we were compelled to go. Well, we asked to go to arbitration.
No, what I'm asking is you told the trial court that you should not be compelled to go to arbitration because AAA is biased, and I understand that was the reason. Assume with me that the trial court said you're right. We'll not send you to AAA, and we'll try the case. You would have gotten the relief that you requested. Why is it different now?
If we would have gone to a different arbitrator,
or a different arbitrator,
that would have been fine. If we had gone to a different arbitrator, they might be appealing that arbitration award.
But you claimed that the arbitration clause was unenforceable.
No, I believe it was the paragraph was titled Objection to AAA.
Well, what do you think, because
AAA requires so much upfront expenses.
I understand that, but the language that I picked up was that the arbitration clause was unenforceable.
I don't believe...
And the record will show that. I don't want to get off on that, but in Tycom International versus Schwartz, it seems to me like that situation is the exact one presented here, and the First Circuit there said, okay, you objected to AAA, but then you had a duty to propose another arbitrator, and by not doing that, you waived the right.
We tried to address that in our responsive brief, Your Honor. We believe Tyco is distinguishable because in the First Circuit, not only did they oppose the AAA, they opposed arbitration overall as well, which we did not do in this case.
Petitioner filed a document called Petitioner's Record Excerpts. It's titled Plaintiff's Response to Warranty Underwriter's Request for Arbitration.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the second page, it says, Plaintiff confirms the purported arbitration clause is unconscionable and unenforceable. Is that not your position at trial?
I believe, Your Honor, what they did is they took out the excerpts. They only gave you a couple pages of the excerpts. And
the pages we have say,
yes.
Unenforceable was your position.
It says
it's in black and white on the signature page.
I understand. They left out the middle pages that say objection to AAA, and then they set forth at length the problems with the AAA. And then it's only at the conclusion, as they go through about the expense and all of those things, they say such exorbitant charges are in violation of the Texas and confirms that the prohibited arbitration clause is unconscionable and unenforceable. With all due respect, Justice Wainwright, that's the exorbitant charges. It's in the same sentence. That's what they're talking about. Is
but the relief
charges.
Is wherefore premises considered. Plaintiffs respectfully pray that this court sustain the objections, deny the plea and abatement in its entirety.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the relief you ask for is not to get sent to somebody else. It's just not to go tall.
And if it had been granted right then and there when you filed that pleading, we wouldn't be here today. Right?
That's, once again, I've got the record speaks for itself, but we're left with what the basis of the objection was. If the prayer was they're objecting to it its entirety, but that obviously the objection was to arbitration.
Now, I understand that your clients ultimately decided that arbitration would get the case resolved more quickly. And one of my concerns is, what about the next case? As a lawyer, could I advise my client that, let's initially oppose arbitration, take advantage of the free discovery that a state court proceeding offers, and then go back once all the facts are developed and move to compel arbitration? That sure would save a lot of money, but that would otherwise go to the arbitrator, but at what cost to the policy favoring arbitration?
Well, I think at either point, the opposing party, if they want to go to arbitration, can move for arbitration at that time. But I think, once again, this court's precedent about establishing harm is critical. There is, if you want to protect the integrity of the arbitration process, I think the real rule there is what this court has already established is the
before
harm.
Before we get to harm, let me just be sure. Do you think if the objection in the first instance had not been focused on AAA as the arbitrator, but had been focused on just arbitration in general, would that be a waiver? We'll come to prejudice, but would that, in your view, would that be a waiver?
I think under certain circumstances it could be considered that.
And then before we get to prejudice, I ask the petitioner where the line should be as far as substantially invoking the judicial process. Where do you think the line should be?
I believe it's the line should be, I think, as well this court has stated in about 10 recent opinions, about the line should be drawn. I think a clear line, obviously, is if they go and seek a resolution on the merits. Move for summary judgment. This court has held that. The Fifth Circuit has held that. That is I think that is at the heart of the issue, because I'll tell you why.
Do you think there's anything short of that?
I think there could be circumstances of getting there.
Like what?
For example?
We're worrying about a rule here. So.
Right, exactly. I understand. Well, I think, you know, if they do go ahead and take or obtain discovery, obviously, that's not obtainable in the arbitration process.
How would you ever know what's going to be available in a later arbitration process before it starts?
I think there's certain, obviously, subpoena power problems, things of that nature, that you would be able to articulate. So, of course, we're trying to get to the prejudice part.
It's almost always completely up to the arbitrator. There may be no discovery if they don't want it.
Yes, possibly. I think some of the rules require it, obviously. But obviously, you will have the prejudice established by the actual discovery that was taken in the litigation. Now, it's also, I think, setting up a really bad precedent if you're going to come in and say, oh, here's the motion to compel arbitration. Oh, defendant, you didn't prove waiver, so I'm sending you guys to arbitration. You go to arbitration for your length of time, your year, and then you come back and say, oh, now I'm going to go prove waiver again.
So you'd like us to create a laundry list of things that they need to do to establish prejudice so there would be a bright line test?
No. I think it is very deferential, Justice Medina, as the U.S. Supreme Court has held, the Fifth Circuit Court, and this court has repeatedly held. This court has taken great lengths to protect the integrity of the arbitration process. And to do so, it has had a strong presumption against waiver. I think this court should stand with that. And additionally, I know I've been questioned about this opposition.
But usually the waiver, every waiver case I've ever seen, it's just nobody said anything. They just filed the suit and everybody started litigating. Somebody discovered an arbitration clause. Are you aware of any waiver case that's ever addressed where somebody actually objected to it?
No, I don't believe the Tyco case, but no one's, there's a Tyco case. Once again,
it just seems to me if we've been arguing for years about waiver from the parties, maybe even didn't know there was an arbitration clause, but they were doing all this discovery. But this is a lot stronger, where somebody knew there was and objected to it, said, I don't want to go, I want to stay here.
Well, with all due respect, you're talking about a decision that was made back in 2001. No defendant objected to the motion to compel arbitration on the grounds that the calls opposed it. Just Judge Farrar was making his decision at that point in time based on what the opposing side had objected to. They never raised it.
But
are we going to come back 7 years later? Are we going to now come back 7 years later before this court and say, you know what, you never raised this issue below, and we're going to allow you to raise that you objected to it for the first time before the Texas Supreme Court?
Oh, but we were. I mean, 4 days before trial, how can arbitration ever be faster if we don't start it until 4 days before the case was going for trial?
The record was clear. The case was not going to go to trial. It was not going to get reached on the docket, and the defendants had filed a motion for continuance. The Coles are an older couple. This was their dream home. It was virtually rendered valueless, and now they were facing for more delays against a very large defendant. They wanted to go to arbitration to try to get a quick resolution. But once again, we're looking at back in 2001, and nobody presented to this judge that they shouldn't go to arbitration because the Coles had opposed it. And now the first time we're hearing about it is before the Supreme Court. Additionally,
let me ask you another question, if I may. In your letter to us, you cite the Howson case recently. That case is not recent, but your letter is recent. And I assume if you knew of a case that said that the invocation of the judicial process was a waiver, that issue was to be decided by the arbitrator rather than the judge, you would have cited it, and you don't. Those cases do use the word waiver, the Howsam case and the cases you cite, but are you aware of a case like this one where the court held that it was an arbitrable issue rather than an issue for the court?
I believe the case I cite, the Global case.
Global Construction.
Global Construction.
It wasn't a delay before trial.
It's not entirely clear. It does use the word delay and uses the word waiver, and I couldn't tell from the opinion whether that was squarely on the plate or not, although they use the words waiver and delay.
This issue has knocked around for a while about when substantially invoking the judicial process is a waiver of arbitration, and it's odd that no court has said that that was should be reserved for the arbitrator.
You know, I've not found a single case that has brought up the issue of waiver in our current state to where they've after gone to arbitration, and then they come back to the court and raise waiver. There's been a national search. No party has cited to this. That's why
why courts don't mandamus it.
Well, I would think that's the time to handle it, is the mandamus issue, like this court has always done. That's the time to resolve the issue. You want to know now whether you waived it or not, right? Otherwise, you got to go through the whole arbitration process.
Well, some people think cases go away on their own if we don't intervene in them.
You're about to run out of time. I want to hear your most compelling argument on why you should prevail.
My most compelling argument is waiver should not even be raised and addressed post-arbitration. It's not part of the. It's not a grounds to vacate the arbitration. Alternatively, Justice Medina, it is an issue for the arbitrator to decide, and they can raise it under whether it was a manifest disregard of the law. They raise that issue in the trial court below. And that's the, I believe, either approach is fine with us, is that you approach it either at the motion to compel arbitration stage, and in any event, they're tied to that record at that time. If it goes to arbitration, let the arbitrator decide whether waiver occurred or didn't occur, because at that point, that can come up the appellate remedy after arbitration under the standard manifest disregard.
Do you dispute Mr. Bracken's assertion that the warranty companies initially sought to compel arbitration, but Perry Holmes did not?
That is correct. I believe that is correct. I will say this at the outset. I've never heard that argument till right now, that Perry Holmes was saying they didn't have an arbitration agreement to force.
Any further questions? Thank you, Tom.
Counsel, if the arbitration or if the waiver provision question was in fact presented to the arbitrator, why should we not review that and defer to the arbitrator and look at it under a manifest disregard of the law process of reviewing the arbitration award as opposed to going back to the trial court?
Yes, there's two things at play here. This court has determined in 2006 that when a trial court grants arbitration, that you can't raise that by way of mandamus. How I take the Palacios case to mean is this is the proper time to bring that issue. And just so we're clear, Perry Holmes is complaining about Judge Farrar's initial decision to send us to arbitration in the first place. And with regard to what was the evidence of the record, it is uncontroverted that trial counsel asked the trial court to take judicial notice of its file, which would necessarily include the Cole's prior express repudiation of arbitration. So, in my opinion, Justice Johnson, we have done what the Supremes have asked us to do in terms of the timing to bring this issue before the court. There was an original motion to compel upon which all the defendants on the record contended that there was waiver. It's in this court's record as well, where trial counsel pointed out the fact that early on in this litigation, the Culls had objected to arbitration, and it was a waiver, and it was unfair to all of the defendants at that time.
Was that pointed out in the motion?
No, but what happened, Judge O'Neill, was there was the motion, and then there was an actual hearing. and there was testimony taken by trial counsel at that time, which is in this record, that pointed out, you know, the procedural history of the case, pointed out the discovery that had been taken. Basically, it was argument by trial counsel.
Presented orally, but not in the motion.
True. And that record is before the court. And then there was a subsequent motion for rehearing where an affidavit that addressed the attorney's fees that had been incurred to date was put in before the court as well.
Was the issue of the calls waiver arbitrated?
I think it was, Justice Heck, but here's the procedural question for this court. The Coles never said while we were before Judge Farrar or Judge Lowe, hey, that's an issue that needs to be considered by the arbitrator. So there's an additional question or collateral question about whether or not the Coles have waived their ability to come before here and say, hey, gotcha, Perry Holmes and the warranty defendants. You guys didn't point that out to the trial court at that time. And one of the things that I find particularly distressing in this whole case is...
But let me be sure. The your position is that the question... whether the Coles waived the waived arbitration by substantially invoking the judicial process was submitted to the arbitrator for decision?
I think the issue of waiver, Justice Heck, was addressed in the body of the arbitration. The issue about whether substantial litigation conduct was waiver, I think, is a question that's peculiarly one for the courts, and that certainly was raised.
Well, let me make sure I understand that posture.
Yes, ma'am.
Do I understand that there were expert witness depositions taken during the arbitration?
Prior to the arbitration.
So at the four-day period before trial, there was still discovery yet to be done.
That's true.
And was it apparent from the record that the case was going to be continued?
I think the case was going to be continued for a short time. At least that was the relief that was requested, I think 30 days or 60 days, to complete the expert depositions prior to trial.
And don't you think... that should play into substantial invocation of the litigation process? I mean, if all the discovery is complete and you're picking a jury in 4 days, that's one situation. The other one is there's still discovery left to do and you're going to get continued, and that's another.
That's why this court has the unique opportunity to address the situation when a plaintiff brings suit in the first instance. The cases seem to indicate that if a plaintiff brings suit in the first instance, they have started the judicial machinery. In my opinion, there should be.
But if they didn't keep a copy of their contract, they forgot about the arbitration clause, they didn't look, it's not, waivers normally got to be intentional, not by accident.
And Justice Brister, on this record, there's no question but that the Coles knew they had an arbitration clause. So we don't have that situation.
But you could have pushed it too. You chose not to push your arbitration clause.
We didn't want to go to arbitration.
As they didn't push theirs at the time.
Right. And so the parties now have gone 13 months down the line. They're ready to go to trial, and on the eve of trial, the Coles changed their mind.
How long did the arbitration last?
I don't know, Your Honor. I wasn't present. I don't know.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.